philosophers of the contemporary analytic school, sometimes called linguistic philosophy by outsiders, have subjected the nuances of the meaning of words and whole utterances to microscopic scrutiny in a variety of quite distinct enterprises. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, the school of ordinary language philosophy lavished attention on the subtle differences between particular words, the differences between doing something deliberately or intentionally or on purpose, to cite a famous instance, Austin, 1961. This gave way to a more formal and systematic set of investigations. Which different propositions could you mean by uttering such sentences as, "Tom believes that Ortcut is a spy"? And what theory accounts for their differences in presupposition, context, and implication? This sort of question is pursued by the subschool that has sometimes been called the Propositional Attitude Task Force, of which some exemplary recent efforts are Peacock, 1992, and Richard, 1992. A different set of investigations was inaugurated by Paul Grice's 1957-1969 Theory of Non-Natural Meaning. This was the attempt to specify the conditions under which a bit of behavior had not just natural meaning, where there's smoke, there's fire, when somebody cries, there's sadness, but the sort of meaning that a speech act has, with its element of conventionality. What has to be the state of a speaker's or hearer's mind for the utterance act to mean anything at all, or to mean a particular thing? Or in other words, what is the relationship between an agent's psychology and the meaning of an agent's words? The relations between these two enterprises is perhaps best seen in Schiffer, 1987. An assumption shared by all these philosophical research programs is that there is one sort of meaning, perhaps divided into many different subsorts, that is language dependent. Before there were words, there were no word meanings, even if there were other sorts of meanings. The further working assumption, particularly among English-speaking philosophers, has been that until we get clear about how words can have meaning, we are unlikely to make much progress on the other varieties of meaning, especially such staggering issues as the meaning of life. But this reasonable assumption has typically had an unnecessary and debilitating side effect. By concentrating first on linguistic meaning, philosophers have distorted their vision of the minds these words depend on, treating them as somehow sui generis, rather than as themselves evolved products of the natural world. This is manifest especially in the resistance philosophers have shown to evolutionary theories of meaning, theories that purport to discern that the meaning of words and all the mental states that somehow lie behind them is grounded ultimately in the rich earth of biological function. On the one hand, few, if any, philosophers have wanted to deny the obvious fact. Human beings are products of evolution, and their capacity to speak, and hence to mean anything, in the relevant sense, is due to a suite of specific adaptations not shared with other products of evolution. On the other hand, philosophers have been reluctant to entertain the hypothesis that evolutionary thinking might shed light on their specific problems about how it is that words and their sources and destinations in people's minds or brains have meaning. There have been important exceptions. Willard Van Orman Quine, 1960, and Wilfred Sellers, 1963, each developed functionalistic theories of meaning that had their roots firmly, if sketchily, planted in biology. Quine, however, hitched his wagon too firmly to the behaviorism espoused by his friend B.F. Skinner, and has been dogged for 30 years with the problem of persuading philosophers, with scant success, that his claims do not succumb to the blanket denunciation of greedy reductionism that was heaped on Skinner and all behaviorists by the ascendant cognitivists. under the direction of Chomsky and Fodor. Sellars, the father of functionalism in the philosophy of mind, said all the right things, but in difficult language that was largely ignored by the cognitivists. See Dennett, 1987b, Chapter 10, for a historical account. Earlier, John Dewey made it clear that Darwinism should be assumed to be the foundation of any naturalistic theory of meaning. No account of the universe in terms merely of the redistribution of matter in motion is complete, no matter how true as far as it goes, for it ignores the cardinal fact that the character of matter in motion and of its redistribution is such as cumulatively to achieve ends, to affect the world of values we know. Deny this, and you deny evolution. Admit it, and you admit purpose in the only objective, that is, the only intelligible sense of that term. I do not say that in addition to the mechanism there are other ideal causes or factors which intervene. I only insist that the whole story be told, that the character of the mechanism be noted, namely, that it is such as to produce and sustain good in a multiplicity of forms. Dewey, 1910, page 34. Note how carefully Dewey wended his way between Scylla and Charybdis. No skyhooks, ideal causes for factors, are called for, but we must not suppose that we can make sense of an uninterpreted version of evolution, an evolution with no functions endorsed, no meanings discerned. More recently, several other philosophers and I have articulated specifically evolutionary accounts of the birth and maintenance of meaning, both linguistic and pre-linguistic. Dennett, 1969, 1978, 1987b, Millikan, 1984, 1993, Israel, 1987, Papineau, 1987. Ruth Millikan's account is by far the most carefully articulated, bristling with implications about the details of the other philosophical approaches to meaning mentioned prior. Her differences with my position have loomed larger for her than for me, but the gap is closing fast. See especially Millikan, 1993, page 155. And I expect the present audiobook to close the gap further, but this is not the place to expose our remaining differences, for they are minor in the context of a larger skirmish, a battle we have not yet won, the battle for any evolutionary account of meaning. Opposed to us, and eminent, if unlikely, bunch of bedfellows, Jerry Fodor, Hilary Putnam, John Searle, Saul Kripke, Tyler Burge, and Fred Dretzky, each in his own way opposed both to evolutionary accounts of meaning and to AI. All six of these philosophers have expressed their reservations about AI, but Fodor has been particularly outspoken in his denunciation of evolutionary approaches to meaning. His diatribes against every naturalist since Dewey, see especially Fodor, 1990, Chapter 2, are often quite funny. For instance, in ridiculing my view, he says, teddy bears are artificial, but real bears are artificial too. We stuff the one, and Mother Nature stuffs the other. Philosophy is full of surprises. Words, according to Humpty Dumpty, get their meanings from us. But whence do we get meaning? What exercises Fodor and these other philosophers is a concern for real meaning as opposed to ersatz meaning, intrinsic or original intentionality, as opposed to derived intentionality. Well might Fodor want to ridicule the idea of organisms as artifacts, for it provides the perspective from which the central flaw in his view, a flaw shared by the views of the five others, can be exposed by a thought experiment. Consider a soft drink vending machine, designed and built in the United States, and equipped with a standard transducer device for accepting and rejecting U.S. quarters. Let's call such a device a two-bitser. Normally, when a quarter is inserted into a two-bitser, it goes into a state, call it Q, which, quote-unquote, means I perceive slash accept a genuine U.S. quarter now. Such two-bitsers are quite, quote-unquote, clever and, quote-unquote, sophisticated. More scare quotes. The thought experiment begins with the assumption that this sort of intentionality is not the real thing, and ends by exposing the embarrassments such an assumption entails. Two-bitsers are hardly foolproof, however. They do make mistakes. To say the same thing unmetaphorically, sometimes they go into state Q when a slug or other foreign object is inserted in them, and sometimes they reject perfectly legal quarters. They fail to go into state Q when they are supposed to. No doubt there are detectable patterns in the cases of misperception. No doubt at least some of the cases of misidentification could be predicted by someone with enough knowledge of the relevant laws of physics and design parameters of the two-bitser's transducing machinery. In other words, it follows just as directly from the laws of physics that objects of kind K would put the device into state Q as that quarters would. Objects of kind K would be good slugs, reliably fooling the transducer. If objects of kind K became more common in the two-bitser's normal environment, we would expect the owners and designers of two-bitsers to develop more advanced and sensitive transducers that would reliably discriminate between genuine U.S. quarters and slugs of kind K. Of course, trickier counterfeits might then make their appearance, requiring further advances in the detecting transducers. At some point, such escalation of engineering would reach diminishing returns, for there is no such thing as a foolproof mechanism. In the meantime, the engineers and users are wise to make do with standard, rudimentary two-bitsers, since it is not cost-effective to protect oneself against negligible abuses. The only thing that makes the device a quarter detector rather than a slug detector or a quarter or slug detector is the environment of shared intentions of the artifact's designers, builders, owners, its users, in short. It is only in the context of those users and their intentions that we can single out some of the occasions of state Q as veridical and others as mistaken. It is only relative to that context of intentions that we could justify calling the device a two-bitser in the first place. I take it that so far I have Fodor, Putnam, Searle, Kripke, Burge, and Dretzky nodding their agreement. That's just how it is with such artifacts. This is a textbook case of derived intentionality laid bare. Such an artifact has no intrinsic intentionality at all. And so it embarrasses no one to admit that a particular two-bitser, straight from the American factory and with Model A two-bitser stamped right on it, might be installed on a Panamanian soft drink machine, where it proceeded to earn its keep as an acceptor and rejecter of quarter Balboas, legal tender in Panama, and easily distinguished from U.S. quarters by the design and writing stamped on them, but not by their weight, thickness, diameter, or material composition. I'm not making this up. I have it on excellent authority, Albert Erler of the Flying Eagle Shop Rare Coins, that Panamanian quarter Balboas minted between 1966 and 1984 are indistinguishable from U.S. quarters by standard vending machines. Small wonder, since they were struck from U.S. quarter stock in American mints. And to satisfy the curious, although it is strictly irrelevant to the example, the exchange rate, when last I checked, for quarter Balboas was indeed 25 cents. Such a two-bitser whisked off to Panama would still normally go into a certain physical state, the state with the physical features by which we used to identify state Q, whenever a U.S. quarter, an object of kind K, or a Panamanian quarter Balboa is inserted in it. But now, a different set of such occasions count as the mistakes. In the new environment, U.S. quarters count as slugs, as inducers of error, misperception, misrepresentation, just as much as objects of kind K do. After all, back in the United States, a Panamanian quarter Balboa is a kind of slug. Once our two-bitzer is resident in Panama, should we say that the state we used to call Q still occurs? The physical state in which the device accepts coins still occurs? But should we now say that we should identify it as realizing a new state? Call it QB instead? At what point would we be entitled to say that the meaning or the function of this physical state of the two-bitzer has shifted? Well, there is considerable freedom, not to say boredom, about what we should say, since after all a two-bitzer is just an artifact. Talking about its perceptions and misperceptions, its veridical and non-veridical states, its intentionality, in short, is just metaphor. The two-bitzer's internal state, call it what you like, doesn't really, originally, intrinsically mean either U.S. quarter here now or Panamanian quarter Balboa here now. It doesn't really mean anything. That's what Fodor, Putnam, Searle, Kripke, Burge, and Dretzky, inter alia, would insist. The two-bitzer was originally designed to be a detector of U.S. quarters. That was its proper function, Millikan, 1984, and quite literally, its raison d'etre. No one would have bothered bringing it into existence had this purpose not occurred to them. This historic fact licenses a way of speaking. We may call the thing a two-bitzer, a thing whose function is to detect quarters, so that relative to that function, we can identify both its veridical states and its errors. This would not prevent the two-bitzer from being wrested from its original niche and pressed, exapted, into new service, whatever new purpose the laws of physics permit and circumstances favor. It could be used as a K-detector, or a slug-detector, a quarter Balboa detector, a doorstop, or a deadly weapon. In its new role, there might be some brief period of confusion or indeterminacy. How long a track record must something accumulate before it is no longer a two-bitzer but a quarter Balboa detector, a Q-balber, we might call it? On its very debut as a Q-balber, after 10 years of faithful service as a two-bitzer, is the state it goes into when presented with a quarter Balboa a veridical detection of a quarter Balboa? Or might there be a sort of force of habit error of nostalgia, a mistaken acceptance of a quarter Balboa as a U.S. quarter? As described, the two-bitzer is ludicrously too simple to count as having the sort of memory we have of our past experiences. But we might take the first step in the direction of providing it with one. Suppose it has a counter on it, which advances each time it goes into its acceptance state, and which stands, after its 10 years of service, at 1,435,792. Suppose the counter is not reset to zero when it is moved to Panama, so that after its debut acceptance of a quarter Balboa, it reads 1,435,793. Does this tip the balance in favor of the claim that it has not yet switched to the task of identifying quarter Balboas? We could go on adding complications and variations, if it might make a difference to our intuitions. Should it? One thing is clear. There is absolutely nothing intrinsic about the two-bitzer considered narrowly all by itself and its internal operations that would distinguish it from a genuine Q-balber made to order on commission from the Panamanian government. What must make the difference, of course, is whether it was selected for its capacity to detect quarter balboas, agreeing with Millikan, 1984. If it was so selected by its new owners in the simplest case, then even if they forget to reset the counter, its maiden move is the veridical acceptance of a quarter balboa. It works, its new owners might exclaim delightedly. If, on the other hand, the two bitzer were sent to Panama by mistake, or arrived by sheer coincidence, then its maiden move would mean nothing, though it might soon come to be appreciated by those in the vicinity for its power to tell quarter balboas from the indigenous slugs, in which case it could come to function as a Q-balber in the fullest meaning of that term, via a less official route. This, by the way, already makes a problem for Searle's view that only artifacts can have functions, and those are the functions its creators endow it with by their very special mental acts of creation. The original designers of the two bitzer may have been entirely oblivious of some later use to which it was opportunistically accepted, so their intentions count for nothing, and the new selectors may also fail to formulate any specific intentions. They may just fall into the habit of relying on the two bitzer for some handy function. Unaware of the act of unconscious acceptation, they are jointly executing. Recall that Darwin, in Origin, already drew attention to unconscious selection of traits in domestic animals. Unconscious selection of traits in artifacts is no stretch at all. It is rather a frequent event, one might suppose. Presumably, Fodor and company will not want to disagree with this treatment of artifacts, which have, they claim, no smidgen of real intentionality. But they may begin to worry that I have maneuvered them onto a buttered slide. For now, let's consider the exactly parallel case of what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain. In Letvin, Maturana, McCulloch, and Pitts's classic article, 1959, another Institute of Radio Engineers masterpiece, they showed that the frog's visual system is sensitive to small moving dark spots on the retina. Tiny shadows cast in almost all natural circumstances by flies flying by in the vicinity. This fly detector mechanism is appropriately wired to the hair trigger in the frog's tongue, which handily explains how frogs feed themselves in a cruel world and thereby help propagate their kind. Now, what does the frog's eye tell the frog's brain? That there is a fly out there? Or that there is a fly or a slug, a fake fly of one sort or another, or a thing of kind F, whatever kind of thing reliably triggers this visual gadget? Millikan, Israel, and I, as Darwinian meaning theorists, have all discussed this very case, and Fodor pounces on it to show what is wrong by his lights with an evolutionary account of such meanings. They are too indeterminate. They fail to distinguish, as they ought, between such frog-eye reports as fly here now and fly or small dark projectile here now, and so forth. But this is false. We can use the frog's environment of selection, to the extent that we can determine what it has been, to distinguish between the various candidates. To do this, we use exactly the same considerations we used to settle the questions, to the extent that they were worth trying to settle, about the meaning of the state in the two bitzer. And to the extent that there is just no telling what that environment of selection has been. There is also just no fact of the matter about what the frog eye report really means. This can be brought home vividly by sending the frog to Panama, or more precisely, sending the frog to a novel selective environment. Suppose scientists gather up a small population of frogs of some fly-grabbing species on the brink of extinction and put them under protective custody in a new environment, a special frog zoo in which there are no flies at all, but rather zookeepers who periodically arrange to launch little food pellets past the frogs in their care. To their delight, It works. The frogs thrive by zapping their tongues for these pellets, and after a while there is a crowd of descendant frogs who have never in their lives seen a fly, only pellets. What do their eyes tell their brains? If you insist on saying the meaning hasn't changed, you are in a bind, for this is simply an artificially clear instance of what happens in natural selection all the time, exaptation. As Darwin was careful to remind us, the reuse of machinery for new purposes is one of the secrets of Mother Nature's success. We can drive home the point to any who wish some further persuasion by supposing that the captive frogs do not all do equally well because, due to variation in pellet-detecting prowess in their eyes, some eat less heartily than others, and leave less progeny as a result. In short order, there will have been undeniable selection for pellet detection, though it would be a mistake to ask exactly when enough of this had occurred for it to count. Unless there were meaningless or indeterminate variation in the triggering conditions of the various frogs' eyes, there could be no raw material, blind variation, for selection for a new purpose to act upon. The indeterminacy that Fodor and others see as a flaw in Darwinian accounts of the evolution of meaning is actually a precondition for any such evolution. The idea that there must be something determinate that the frog's eye really means, some possibly unknowable proposition in froggish that expresses exactly what the frog's eye is telling the frog's brain, is just essentialism applied to meaning, or function. Meaning, like function, on which it so directly depends, is not something determinate at its birth. It arises not by saltation or special creation, but by a typically gradual shift of circumstances. Now we are ready for the only case that really matters to these philosophers. What happens when we move a person from one environment to another? This is the notorious twin earth thought experiment of Hilary Putnam, 1975. I am reluctant to go into the details, but I have learned that nothing short of spelling it all out and blocking all the exits will have a prayer of persuading those whose allegiances lie with original intentionality. So with apologies, here goes. Armed with our background briefing on the two Bitzer and the frog, we can see exactly what the twin earth thought experiment depends on for its undeniable rhetorical force. Twin earth, let's suppose, is a planet almost exactly like earth, except that there are no horses on twin earth. There are animals that look just like horses and are called horses by the inhabitants of twin Boston and twin London, chevaux, by the inhabitants of twin Paris, and so forth. That's how similar twin Earth is to Earth. But these twin Earth animals are not horses. They are something else. Call them schmorses, and, if you like, you may suppose they are a sort of pseudo-mammal, a hairy reptile or whatever. This is philosophy, and you get to make up whatever details you find you need to make your thought experiment work. Now comes the dramatic part. One night, while you sleep, you are whisked off to twin Earth. It is important that you sleep through this momentous change, for that keeps you in the dark about what has happened to you. It keeps you in the same state you were in on Earth. When you awake, you look out the window and a schmorse gallops by. "Lo, a horse," you say. Out loud or just to yourself, it makes no difference. To make the case simple, let's suppose Twining, a handy twin earthling, utters the very same sounds at the very same time when he, too, sees the schmorse gallop by. Here is what Putnam and others insist on. Twining says and thinks something true, namely, that a schmorse has just run by. You, earthling that you still are, say and think something false, namely, that a horse has just run by. How long, though, would you have to live on twin Earth, calling schmorses horses, just like all the natives, before the state of your mind, or what your eye tells your brain, is a truth about schmorses rather than a falsehood about horses. When does the aboutness, or intentionality, leap to the new position? A saltation demanded by these theorists. Would you ever make the transition? Would you somehow make it without knowing it? The two-bitser was forever oblivious of the change of meaning of its internal state, after all. I suppose you may be inclined to think that you are quite radically unlike the frog and the two-bitser. You, it may seem, have intrinsic or original intentionality, and this marvelous property has a certain amount of inertia. Your brain can't just turn on a dime and suddenly mean something entirely new by its old state. In contrast, frogs don't have much of a memory, and two-bitsers none at all. What you mean by the word horse, your private mental concept of a horse, is something like one of those equinish beasts that we earthlings like to ride, an epithet anchored in your mind by all your memories of horse shows and cowboy movies. Let us agree that this memory matrix fixes the kind of thing to which your concept of horse applies. Ex hypothesi, schmorses are not beasts of that kind. They are not of the same species at all, but just conveniently indistinguishable by you from horses. So, according to this line of thought, you make unwitting errors every time you misclassify a schmorse perceptually or in reflection. Wasn't that a fine horse I saw gallop by my window yesterday? But there is another way of thinking of the same example. Nothing forces us to suppose that your concept of a horse wasn't more relaxed in the first place, rather like your concept of a table. Try telling the story of Twin Earth with the suggestion that the tables there aren't really tables, but just look like tables and are used for tables. It doesn't work, does it? Horses and schmorses may not be the same biological species, but what if you, like most earthlings, have no clear concept of species and classify by appearance? Living thing that looks like man-o-war. Horses and schmorses both fall into that kind. So when you call a twin earth beast a horse, you're right after all. Given what you mean by horse, schmorses are horses. A non-earthly kind of horse, but a horse just the same. Non-earthly tables are tables too. It is clear that you could have such a relaxed concept of horses, and that you could have a tighter concept, according to which schmorses are not horses, not being of the same earthly species. Both cases are possible. Now, must it be determinate whether your horse concept, prior to your move, meant the species or the wider class? It might be, if you are well read in biology, for instance. But suppose you are not. Then your concept, what horse actually means to you, would suffer the same indeterminacy as the frog's concept of fly. Or was it all along the concept small airborne food item? It might help to have a more realistic example, something that could happen right here on Earth. I have been told that it once was the case that the Siamese had a word for, well, cat, but had never seen or imagined any other cats than Siamese cats. Let's suppose their word was cat with a K. It doesn't matter what the actual details were, or even whether this particular tale is true. It could be. When they discovered that other varieties existed, they had a problem. Did their word mean cat or Siamese cat? Had they just discovered that there were other rather different-looking sorts of cats with a K, or that cats with a K and those other creatures belonged to a supergroup? Was their traditional term the name of a species or a variety? If they lacked the biological theory that made this distinction, how could there possibly be a fact of the matter? Well, they might discover that peculiarities of appearance were really very important to them. That just doesn't look like a cat with a K, so it isn't one. And you might discover that you, similarly, resisted the suggestion that Shetland ponies were horses. When a Siamese person saw a non-Siamese cat walking by and thought, "Lo, a cat with a K," would this be an error or the simple truth? Perhaps the Siamese person wouldn't have any opinion about how to answer this question. But could there nevertheless be a determinate fact about whether this was an error? Something we might never be able to discover, but a fact nonetheless? The same thing could happen to you, after all. Imagine that a biologist told you one day that coyotes are in fact dogs, members of the same species. You might find yourself wondering whether the biologist and you had the same concept of dog. How strong was your allegiance to the view that dog was a species term and not the name for a large subspecies of domestic dogs? Does your heart of hearts tell you loud and clear that you had already ruled out, by definition, the hypothesis that coyotes are dogs? Or does it silently allow that your concept has all along had the openness to admit this purported discovery? Or would you find that now that the issue has been raised, you would have to settle one way or the other, something that had simply not been fixed before, because it had never come up before? Such a threat of indeterminacy undermines the argument in Putnam's thought experiment. To preserve its point, Putnam tries to plug this gap by declaring that our concepts, whether we know it or not, refer to natural kinds. But which kinds are natural? Varieties are just as natural as species, which are as natural as genera and higher classifications. Essentialism with regard to the meaning of the frog's mental state and the two bitzers' inner state, Q or QB, was seen to evaporate. It must evaporate just as surely for us. The frog would have zapped just as readily at pellets in the wild, had any come its way. So it certainly was not equipped with anything that discriminated against pellets. In one sense, fly or pellet is a natural kind for frogs. They naturally fail to discriminate between the two. In another sense, fly or pellet is not a natural kind for frogs. Their natural environment has never made that classification relevant before. Exactly the same is true for you. Had schmorses been secretly brought to Earth, you would have just as readily called them horses. You would have been wrong if it was somehow already fixed that what your term meant was the species, not the lookalikes. But if not, there would be no grounds at all for calling your classification an error, since the distinction had never before come up. Like the frog and the two-bitzer, you have internal states that get their meanings from their functional roles, and where function fails to yield an answer, there is nothing more to inquire about. The tale of Twin Earth, if we read it through Darwinian spectacles, proves that human meanings are just as derived as the meanings of two-bitzers and frogs. This is not what it was intended to show. But any attempt to block this interpretation is forced to postulate mysterious and unmotivated doctrines of essentialism, and to insist, point blank, that there are facts about meaning that are utterly inert and undiscoverable, but facts all the same. Since some philosophers are ready to swallow these bitter pills, I need to provide a few further persuasions. The idea that our meanings are just as dependent on function as the meanings of the states of artifacts, and hence just as derivative and potentially indeterminate, strikes some philosophers as intolerable because it fails to give meaning a proper causal role. This is an idea we have seen in an earlier incarnation, as the worry about minds being mere effects, not originating causes. If meaning gets determined by the selective forces that endorse certain functional roles, then all meaning may seem, in a sense, to be only retrospectively attributed. What something means is not an intrinsic property it has, capable of making a difference in the world at the moment of its birth, but at best, a retrospective coronation, secured only by an analysis of the subsequent effects engendered. That is not quite right. An engineering analysis of the two bitzer, newly arrived in Panama, would permit us to say what roles the device, so configured, would be good for, even if it had not yet been chosen for any role. We could reach this verdict. Its acceptance state could mean quarter Balboa here now, if we put it in the right environment. But of course, it could also mean lots of other things, if placed in other environments, so it won't mean any one of them until a particular functional role for it gets established. And there is no threshold for how long it takes a functional role to become established. That is not enough for some philosophers, who think that meaning, so construed, doesn't pull its weight. The clearest expression of this idea is Fred Dretske's, 1986, insistence that meaning must itself play a causal role in our mental lives in a way that meaning never plays a causal role in the career of an artifact. Put this way, the attempt to distinguish real meaning from artificial meaning betrays a yearning for skyhooks, a yearning for something principled that could block the gradual emergence of meaning from some cascade of mere purposeless, mechanical causes. But this is, you must suspect, an optional and tendentious way of putting it. As usual, the issues are more complex than I am describing. But we can force the key points into the open with the help of a little fable I recently devised precisely to give these philosophers fits. It works. First the fable, and then the fits. Two black boxes. Once upon a time, there were two large black boxes, A and B, connected by a long insulated copper wire. On box A, there were two buttons marked A and B. And on box B, there were three lights, red, green, and amber. Scientists studying the behavior of the boxes had observed that whenever you pushed the A button on box A, the red light flashed briefly on box B. And whenever you pushed the B button on box A, the green light flashed briefly. The amber light never seemed to flash. They performed a few billion trials under a very wide variety of conditions and found no exceptions. There seemed to them to be a causal regularity, which they conveniently summarized thus. All A's cause reds, all B's cause greens. The causation passed through the copper wire somehow, they determined, since severing it turned off all effects in box B. And shielding the two boxes from each other without severing the wire never disrupted the regularity. So naturally they were curious to know just how the causal regularity they had discovered was affected through the wire. Perhaps they thought pressing button A caused a low voltage pulse to be emitted down the wire, triggering the red light, and pressing button B caused a high voltage pulse, which triggered the green. Or perhaps pressing A caused a single pulse, which triggered the red light, and pressing B caused a double pulse. Clearly there was something that always happened in the wire when you pressed button A, and something different that always happened in the wire when you pressed B. Discovering just what this was would explain the causal regularity they had discovered. A wiretap of sorts on the wire soon revealed that things were more complicated. Whenever either button was pushed on box A, a long stream of pulses and gaps, ons and offs, or bits, was sent swiftly down the wire to box B, 10,000 bits to be exact. But it was a different pattern each time. Clearly, there had to be a feature or property of the strings of bits that triggered the red light in one case and the green light in the other. What could it be? They decided to open up Box B and see what happened to the strings of bits when they arrived. Inside B, they found a supercomputer. Just an ordinary digital serial supercomputer with a large memory, containing a huge program and a huge database, written, of course, in more bit strings. And when they traced the effects of the incoming bit strings on this computer program, they found nothing out of the ordinary. The input string would always make its way into the central processing unit in normal fashion, where it would provoke a few billion operations to be performed in a few seconds, ending, always, with either of two output signals, a 1, which turned on the red light, or a 0, which turned on the green light. In every case, they found they could explain each step of the causation at the microscopic level without any difficulty or controversy. No occult causes were suspected to be operating, and, for instance, when they arranged to input the same sequence of 10,000 bits again and again, the program in Box B always yielded the same output, red or green. But this was mildly puzzling, because although it always gave the same output, it didn't always yield the same output by going through the same intermediate steps. In fact, it almost always passed through different states before yielding the same output. This in itself was no mystery, since the program kept a copy of each input it received, and so when the same input arrived a second or third or thousandth time, the state of the memory of the computer was slightly different each time, but the output was always the same. If the light turned red the first time a particular string was input, it always turned red for the same string thereafter. And the same regularity held for the green strings, as the scientists began to call them. All strings, they were tempted to hypothesize, are either red strings, cause the red light to flash, or green strings, cause the green light to flash. But of course, they hadn't tested all possible strings, only strings that had been emitted by Box A. So they decided to test their hypothesis by disconnecting A from B temporarily and inserting variations on A's output strings to B. To their puzzlement and dismay, they discovered that almost always when they tampered with a string from A, the amber light flashed. It was almost as if Box B had detected their intervention. There was no doubt, however, that Box B would readily accept man-made versions of red strings by flashing red and man-made versions of green strings by flashing green. It was only when a bit, or more than one bit, was changed in a red or green string that the amber light usually, almost always, came on. "You've killed it," somebody once blurted out, after watching a tampered red string turn into an amber string, and this led to a flurry of speculation that red and green strings were in some sense alive, perhaps male and female, whereas amber strings were dead strings. But appealing as this hypothesis was, it did not turn out to lead anywhere, although further experimentation with a few billion random variations on bit strings of 10,000 bits in length did strongly suggest to the scientists that there were really three varieties of strings: red strings, green strings, and amber strings. And amber strings outnumbered red and green strings by many, many orders of magnitude. Almost all strings were amber strings. That made the regularity they had discovered all the more exciting and puzzling. What was it about red strings that turned on the red light and green strings that turned on the green light? Of course, in each particular case, there was no mystery at all. They could trace the causation of each particular string through the supercomputer in B and see that, with gratifying determinism, it produced its red or green or amber light, as the case might be. What they couldn't find, however, was a way of predicting which of the three effects a new string would have, just by examining it, without hand simulating its effect on Box B. They knew from their empirical data that the odds were very high that any new string considered would be amber, unless it was a string known to have been emitted by Box A, in which case the odds were better than a billion to one that it would be either red or green, but no one could tell which without running it through Box B to see how the program settled out. Since, in spite of much brilliant and expensive research, they found themselves still utterly unable to predict whether a string would turn out to be red, green, or amber, some theorists were tempted to call these properties emergent properties. What they meant was that the properties were, they thought, unpredictable in principle from a mere analysis of the micro-properties of the strings themselves. But this didn't seem likely at all, since each particular case was as predictable as any deterministic input to a deterministic program could be. In any event, whether or not the properties of red, green, and amber were unpredictable in principle or merely in practice, they certainly were surprising and mysterious properties. Perhaps the solution to the mystery lay in Box A. They opened it up and found another supercomputer, of a different make and model, and running a different gigantic program, but also just a garden-variety digital computer. They soon determined that whenever you pushed button A, this sent the program off in one way, by sending a code, 11111111, to the CPU. And whenever you pushed button B, this sent a different code, 00000000, to the CPU, setting in motion a different set of billions of operations. It turned out that there was an internal clock ticking away millions of times a second. And whenever you pushed either button, the first thing the computer did was take the time from the clock. For example, 10110101010101111. And break it up into strings it then used to determine which subroutines to call in which order, and which part of its memory to access first in the course of its preparation of a bit string to send down the wire. The scientists were able to figure out that it was this clock consulting, which was as good as random, that virtually guaranteed that the same bit string was never sent out twice. But in spite of this randomness, or pseudo-randomness, it remained true that whenever you pushed button A, the bit string the computer concocted turned out to be red. And whenever you pushed button B, the bit string eventually sent turned out to be green. Actually, the scientists did find a few anomalous cases. In roughly 1 in a billion trials, pushing the A button caused a green string to be emitted, or pushing the B button caused a red string to be emitted. This tiny blemish in perfection only whetted the scientists' appetite for an explanation of the regularity. And then one day, along came the two AI hackers who had built the boxes, and they explained it all. Do not listen further if you want to figure out the mystery for yourself. Al, who had built Box A, had been working for years on an expert system, a database containing true propositions about everything under the sun, and an inference engine to deduce further implications from the axioms that compose the database. There were Major League Baseball statistics, meteorological records, biological taxonomies, histories of the world's nations, and hosts of trivia in the database. Bo, the Swede who had built Box B, had been working during the same time on a rival world knowledge database for his own expert system. They had both stuffed their respective databases with as many truths as years of work had permitted. But as the years progressed, they had grown bored with expert systems and had both decided that the practical promise of this technology was vastly overrated. The systems weren't actually very good at solving interesting problems or thinking or finding creative solutions to problems. All they were good at, thanks to their inference engines, was generating lots and lots of true sentences in their respective languages and testing input sentences in their respective languages for truth and falsity, relative to their knowledge, of course. So Al and Bo had got together, and figured out how the fruits of their wasted effort could be put to use. They decided to make a philosophical toy. They chose a lingua franca for translating between their two representational systems. It was English, actually, sent in standard ASCII code, the code of electronic mail, and hooked the machines together with a wire. Whenever you pushed A's A button, this instructed A to choose at random, or pseudo-random, one of its beliefs, either a stored axiom or a generated implication of its axioms, translated into English. In a computer, English characters would already be in ASCII. Add enough random bits after the period to bring the total up to 10,000 and send the resulting string to B, which translated this input into its own language, which was Swedish Lisp, and tested it against its own beliefs, its database. Since both databases were composed of truths, and roughly the same truths, thanks to their inference engines, whenever A sent B something A believed, B believed it too, and signaled this by flashing a red light. Whenever A sent B what A took to be a falsehood, B announced that it judged that this was indeed a falsehood by flashing a green light. And whenever anyone tampered with the transmission, this almost always resulted in a string that was not a well-formed sentence of English. B had absolutely zero tolerance for typographical errors. B responded to these by flashing the amber light. Whenever anyone chose a bit string at random, the odds were vast that it would not be a well-formed truth or falsehood of English ASCII. Hence, the preponderance of amber strings. So, said Al and Bo, the emergent property red was actually the property of being a true sentence of English, and green was the property of being a falsehood in English. Suddenly, the search that had eluded the scientists for years became child's play. Anyone could compose red strings ad nauseam. Just write down the ASCII code for houses are bigger than peanuts, or whales don't fly, or 3 times 4 is 2 less than 2 times 7, for instance. If you wanted a green string, try 9 is less than 8, or New York is the capital of Spain. Philosophers soon hit upon cute tricks, such as finding strings that were red the first 100 times they were given to be, but green thereafter. For example, the ASCII for "This sentence has been sent to you for evaluation fewer than 101 times. But, said some philosophers, the string properties red and green are not really truth in English and falsity in English. After all, there are English truths whose ASCII expression takes millions of bits. And besides, in spite of their best efforts, Al and Bo didn't always insert facts in their programs. Some of what had passed for common knowledge when they were working on their databases had since been disproven, and so forth. There were lots of reasons why the string property, the causal property, of redness was not quite exactly the property of truth in English. So perhaps red could better be defined as relatively short expression in English ASCII of something believed true by box B, whose beliefs are almost all true. This satisfied some, but other picked nits, insisting, for various reasons, that this definition was inexact, or had counterexamples that could not be ruled out in any non-ad hoc way, and so forth. But as Al and Bo pointed out, there were no better candidate descriptions of the property to be found. And hadn't the scientists been yearning for just such an explanation? Hadn't the mystery of red and green strings now been entirely dissolved? Moreover, now that it was dissolved, couldn't one see that there wasn't any hope at all of explaining the causal regularity with which we began our tale without using some semantical or mentalistic terms? Some philosophers argued that, though the newfound description of the regularity in the activity in the wire could be used to predict Box B's behavior, it was not a causal regularity after all. Truth and falsehood, or any of the adjusted stand-ins just considered, are semantic properties, and as such are entirely abstract, and hence could not cause anything. Nonsense, others retorted. Pushing button A causes the red light to go on, just as certainly as turning the ignition key causes your car to start. If it had turned out that what was being sent down the wire was simply high versus low voltage, or one pulse versus two, everybody would agree that this was a paradigm causal system. The fact that this system turned out to be a Rube Goldberg machine didn't show that the reliability of the link between A and red flashes was any less causal. On the contrary, in every single case, the scientists could trace out the exact microcausal path that explained the result. Convinced by this line of reasoning, other philosophers began to argue that this showed that the properties red, green, and amber weren't really semantical or mentalistic properties after all, but only imitation semantical properties, mere as-if semantical properties. What red and green were really were very, very complicated syntactical properties. These philosophers declined, however, to say anything further about just what syntactical properties these were, or to explain how even young children could swiftly and reliably produce instances of them or recognize them. The philosophers were nevertheless convinced that there had to be a purely syntactic description of the regularity, since, after all, the causal systems in question were just computers, and computers are just syntactic engines, not capable of any real semanticity. I suppose, retorted Al and Bo, that if you had found us inside our black boxes, playing a trick on you by following the same scheme, you would then relent and agree that the operative causal property was genuine truth, or believed truth in any event. Can you propose any good reason for drawing such a distinction? This led some to declare that in a certain important sense, Al and Bo had been in the boxes, since they were responsible for creating the respective databases as models of their own beliefs. It led others to deny that there really were any semantical or mentalistic properties anywhere in the world. Content, they said, had been eliminated. The debate went on for years, but the mystery with which we began was solved. 3. Blocking the exits. The tale ends there. Experience teaches, however, that there is no such thing as a thought experiment so clearly presented that no philosopher can misinterpret it. So, in order to forestall some of the most attractive misinterpretations, I will inelegantly draw attention to a few of the critical details and explain their roles in this intuition pump. 1. The devices in boxes A and B are nothing but automated encyclopedias, not even walking encyclopedias, just boxes of truths. Nothing in the story presupposes or implies that these devices are conscious or thinking things or even agents, except in the same minimal sense in which a thermostat is an agent. They are utterly boring intentional systems, rigidly fixed to fulfilling a single, simple goal. They contain large numbers of true propositions and the inferential machinery necessary to generate more truths and to test for truth by testing a candidate proposition against their existing databases. Since the two systems were created independently, they cannot plausibly be supposed to contain exactly the same truths, actually or even virtually, but for the prank to work as well as I claim it did in the story, we must suppose a very large overlap, so that it was highly unlikely that a truth generated by A would not be recognized as such by B. Two considerations, I claim, make this plausible. A. Al and Bo may live in different countries and have different native languages, but they inhabit the same world. And B. Although there are gazillions of true propositions about that world, our world, the fact that both Al and Bo set out to create useful databases containing the information that is relevant to all but the most recherché of human purposes, would guarantee a high degree of overlap between the two independently created systems. Although Al might know that at noon on his 20th birthday, his left foot was closer to the North Pole than to the South Pole, and Beau had not forgotten that his first French teacher was named DuPont, these would not be truths that either would be apt to put in his database. But if you doubt that the mere fact that they were both intent on creating an intentionally useful encyclopedia would ensure such a close correspondence between their respective databases, just add, as an inelegant detail, the convenient fact that they compared notes as to topics to be covered during their years of hacking. 2. Why not just have Al and Bob, a fellow American, or for that matter, why not simply have a duplicate of Al's system in Box B? Because it must be the essence, oops, of my story that no simple, feasibly discoverable syntactic matching up could explain the regularity. That is why Beau's system is in Swedish Lisp, to conceal from prying eyes the underlying semantic commonalities between the data structures consulted during A's sentence generation task and B's sentence translation and truth testing task. The idea was to create two systems that exhibited the fascinating regularity of external behavior described, but that were internally as different as possible, so that only the fact that their respective innards were systematic representations of a common world could explain the regularity. 3. We might pause to ask whether or not two such systems could ever be so inscrutable as to be invulnerable to reverse engineering. Cryptography has moved into such rarefied and arcane regions that one should think thrice at least before declaring either way. I have no idea whether anybody can make a sound argument to the effect that there are unbreakable encryption schemes or that there aren't. But encryption aside, hackers will appreciate that all the convenient comments and other signposts one places in the source code when composing a program vanish when the source code is compiled, leaving behind an almost impossible to decipher tangle of machine instructions. Decompiling is sometimes possible in practice. Is it always possible in principle? Though, of course, it won't restore the comments, but just render salient the structures in the higher-level language. My assumption that the scientists' efforts at decompiling the program and deciphering the databases came to naught